Welcome to Her Story Podcast.
Son histoire à elle, un balado bilingue qui met en valeur non seulement le succès des femmes du Québec, mais qui souligne leur pratique et vie de tous les jours. I'll be talking with creative, successful and game-changing women who are inspiring and relatable in the ordinary and extraordinary lives they lead. May 12th is Mother's Day here in Canada, and I wanted to spend a little bit more than just one day to honor our mothers. So here on the Her Story podcast, the entire month of May will be a dedication to mothers and mother figures with a new podcast every week. À chaque semaine, durant le mois de mai, je parlerai donc avec cinq personnes qui détiennent le premier rôle de maman, tout en vivant une vie sociale et professionnelle bien remplie. This series is an ode to the people who are mothers, who are doing the best they can every day. They'll be sharing with us their triumphs and their failures. And I think we can all either draw wisdom from or feel comfort in relating to their stories. Si cette série ou les autres épisodes du podcast vous inspirent, faites-le moi savoir. Abonnez-vous au podcast pour recevoir chaque épisode automatiquement sur vos tablettes. Je vous remercie pour votre support et votre écoute. This week, I sat down with the mother of all mothers, my mom, Diana Gregg Stavert. She has over 30 years of mothering experience and at 70 years old, sure has a story to tell. We went on a journey from learning how to produce maple syrup in her backyard in the 1950s to the challenges of being a working woman in the 60s and delivering babies as an outpost nurse in isolated communities in northern Quebec, to being an older mother in the 80s and 90s. This was an emotional episode for me as she tells us about her experience with miscarriage and postpartum depression. My mother is one of the most open-hearted and generous women I know, and I am proud to share her story with you. Hi, this is Kathleen Stavert, your host of the Her Story podcast, and this is a very special podcast for me because I have my mother. There may be tears. Diana Gregg Stavert on the podcast. This is the second episode of the Mother's Day series. Hi, Mom.
Hi.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for asking me.
Mom, what is your story and what are some of the major events in your life that led you to where you are now?
Where do I start?
That's what I'm asking you. Where do you start?
Well,
where does your story start? Can we start by saying your age? Just because I have a range of women on the show.
Yeah. Okay, I am 70 years old.
Leo.
I will be 71 in August. I was born in Quebec City. My parents were not conventional in that my father was 55 when he got married, and therefore I was born when he was 58. He was retired shortly after that, so he was always at home when I was growing up, even as a little girl. He wanted a boy. And he didn't get one. He had three girls. And so I was his boy. I did everything boys did. I climbed trees. I ran. I played in the garden.
Broke various body parts.
Not early on. I was, actually took me quite a bit of time to break body parts. I have a very strong bony structure. I guess... I was the one that wanted to be around my dad more than anything. So I played outdoors. And I much preferred to be outdoors than to be indoors. My older sister, Jane, was very much Miss Perfect. And when it was all right that she was a girl, but the fact that I was not a boy was not as good. I'd come 2 years after she was born. So it was easier for me to be outdoors with Dad, and be the boy, than it was to be the pretty little girl at home. Jane did that for me. I used to ride my bike everywhere. I climbed the hills. We had a wonderful property where we could play anywhere and everything was very safe. We could go off and play in the woods for the whole day.
And something that I learned recently is that you basically had a sugar shack, a cabane à sucre.
We did have a cabane à sucre.
So you would go topping maple.
Well, that was just, it's a very short, brief time of the year. You tap as soon as the sun hits the south side of the trees. There has to be a certain amount of sunlight in order to capture the sap from the trees, and the sap runs up the trees. Dad was always pretty good at, you know, we had a sort of 3-day window to tap the trees. And then we tapped the same ones every year because you only tap sugar maples. And so I would go out and tap trees with Dad, and then we'd get the cans on. And then we'd have to haul this stuff around, and we had what we called a sled. I got to know it as a Komatik later on, with a big, big barrel on it. And so we used to pull this sled through the snow, often on snowshoes, because the snow became quite porous in the spring, and we'd pull this sled along. And by the time we got it to where it was going to be boiled, it was pretty heavy. Dad was really, really strong. There was no, you know, he would sort of, you know, pick up the slack. But as kids, we learned how to pull it. And if it took two of us to pull it, well, two of us would pull it. And my grandfather lived across the road from us. So every Saturday and Sunday during sugaring season, he would come over and he would do the boiling. And my father built a fire pit out of bricks, and it was very sturdy, and we had a pan that was 3 feet by 5 feet in basic size, and about 10 inches deep. And that would fit onto this fire pit exactly. And we would then put the sap in that, and it would be boiled on Saturdays and Sundays. So we'd collect sap all week in order to boil down to make the syrup. And we would boil that until it would then be poured into a large pot. That was and you boil down, it's 80-1 to make syrup. So, you know, the boiling would start. I guess Granddad would have got the fire going by 9, and he wouldn't finish off until about 4:30 or 5. And he would stoke that fire and keep that burning, and then do all the skimming all day. And, of course, these were weekends, so Dad would be continually emptying the sap. But this, you see, we had a 3-week period, so it wasn't a long period.
And yeah. Still, to this day, maple syrup is one of your favorite things, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, yes. Maple syrup is certainly one of my favorite things. But making it was great fun. It was mm-hmm. really was. And in the smell in the shack, of course, this aroma would be everywhere, just impermeating the air. So, you know, you'd walk into this fog, really a fog of maple smells from the early boiling until then it would go into a big pot, and then my mum looked after it in the house, and she would boil it to syrup, mm-hmm. and then she'd bottle it through, if you can imagine, a applesauce strainer. It's sort of like a cylindrical strainer with a felt liner. So this was a really heavy felt liner. It's probably about a quarter of an inch thick anyway, and then you'd pour it through that, and it took forever to leak through that. But what came out was clear maple syrup. And you boiled it just to syrup and then put it into the jars. And we used to make, by the time, you know, do the 3 weeks, the early syrup is always the lighter one. It has the lighter syrup has not lighter in sugar or anything else. It has to do with the time of year that it's collected.
Oh,
and so the darker syrup you get is because there are more impurities in it.
Oh, is that what it is? Is that still that still holds true today?
Yeah, there are more impurities in the darker. Or it's more other things that have come up from the ground that are now in the sap, and when it's boiled down, it becomes, it's just a darker syrup. So it's...
so all this time outside with your father, did that lead to any of your sort of life choices later on, your education that you wanted? Or I know you did a lot of girl guiding.
I wanted to be a vet. I really wanted to be a vet. I thought that, oh, I could look after animals. But I probably could have. But
at one point in our house growing up, we had a dog, two cats, two rabbits, two turtles, a bird, and a salamander all at once.
Well, I guess I was
much to
my own
much
home.
To Dad's dismay. Yeah, you're a vet in your own home.
Yeah, but when it came time in the 60s to think about going to university, a girl had a terrible time getting into veterinary college. It was just not the profession for women. And the requirements were a lot higher than I wanted to study for. I was never a good student.
So a veterinarian was seen as like a man's career?
Completely.
Just like a doctor would have been in those days?
Yes. Wow. Girls didn't do veterinary medicine because, first of all, well, a girl could never handle a horse because girls didn't handle horses. Girls didn't work farms. It's why it's so much fun now.
I'm sorry, but if a woman can, if she can let something, a human being, come out of her vagina, I think she can handle a horse in a farm. I'm sorry.
In the 21st century, yes, but not in the 1960s. And prior to that, definitely not. It was not, if women were considered second-class citizens. I can still remember when my mom acquired the property from my grandfather, and she had to have my dad sign for it. Well, Dad was never sexist. Dad believed that mom could do anything. He believed that his mother could do anything, and she died in the 30s. So, you know, we're not, my father was never ever thought that he was any better than mum was. In fact, he probably thought himself inferior to my mum in many ways because she was so much more capable than he was. But the idea that he should have to sign for her, of course, she didn't like that. He didn't like that either. So it was a different time. And so I did not go into veterinary medicine. And really, my marks were not superb at school. I got through, but I liked doing other things rather than studying.
Like what?
Well, even in elementary school, I played basketball. I ran, I did track. Yes, I did guiding. Brownie, we didn't have Sparks in those days, but Brownie, guide, ranger. And then I took on a company of my own as a guide leader. What else did I do? It's looking back on it, I did anything anybody. I had my limits. My sister always did things on dares, which I couldn't do. I was not daring in that way. But again, I still like to be outdoors more than I like to be indoors.
So what did you decide to do?
Well, when I finished school, finished high school, I took a secretarial course because I thought, you know, it might prove useful. I really at that point had decided that probably veterinary medicine was not in the books for me. And I had to decide what I wanted to do. And I took a secretarial course, and at the same time I was working in retail, which I'd done summers and Christmas and for many years, most of from the time I was 15 on, I guess. And then I got through the secretarial school, did very well at that, because the secretarial school I went to asked for skills that I had, like speaking in public. I loved speaking in public. leadership roles, and those came naturally. And so I went and worked at a number of different offices, ending up in an office, in a stockbroker's office, which was interesting. But it didn't take more than about a year and a half before I realized that it wasn't going to last. And
Is that because of the precarious nature of stock brokerage?
No.
Brokering stuff? Or you office. Weren't going to last
I wasn't
going to last
in an office. It was too confining. And I had a boss who was very much part of a period when two solitudes and where in Quebec City especially, the French had been so repressed, and suddenly they were gaining a voice and Anglophones were losing theirs, and I was treated pretty badly, I think. The other girl in the office who spoke no English at all got twice my salary. My boss used to, tease me about my size. It was basic harassment. And I used to smile sweetly and say, oh, je comprends pas. And so he didn't think I understood French. And it was my way of getting him off my back, and it did, because it just made him mad. And he went into his office and slammed the door, so I got off. It was great. But yet, you know, I would talk, I was bonded, and I could deliver and pick up securities from all his clients. And I always spoke to them, and they all knew I spoke French, but he didn't. So
you decided this was
it was a bad or... it was just a bad situation, but I thought that it would probably be the same in most offices at that period, because the situation was very difficult. It was whether it was difficult for Anglophones especially, no, it was just a very difficult
or even
time
just for women.
Having a career. Anyway, one of my options was nursing, because it was very cheap education in those days. And since I had made very little money, I spent almost all my salary just traveling back and forth to work. So I went to, I applied to get into nursing, and I had graduated through McGill University on my matric. And that gave me a bit more credit than I would have had graduating from a regular public school in Quebec City. And my exams were all taken at McGill. They were the first year university courses that were exams. And I hadn't done terribly well. As I said, I wasn't a great student, but I had passed and was accepted in nursing at Humber College in Toronto, that's nice. I had never been to Toronto, didn't know anything about it. But this was all very interesting. It was almost like an adventure. It was an adventure. So went off to Toronto. And when I got to Toronto, Humber said, oh, no, we don't need you here. But we're sending you to St. Joseph's Hospital, because they don't have their contingent of mature students, because at that point, that's what I was.
How old were you?
23. So I went to St. Joe's, and St. Joe's had a residence, which was even better because if I'd been at Humber, I would have had to find an apartment. And as I said, there wasn't much money. I knew I'd have to work during training because there wasn't the money there. So I did a lot of babysitting in those days, and that I loved. I loved my kids. I had three families, I guess, that I babysat most for. But it was good. It didn't take me long to figure out that I loved nursing. In, I guess, the first... we had about a month or maybe 6 weeks of preparation time, and then we got on the wards for the first time, when we basically, what we did was go in and talk to people and then give them a bed bath. So we had to go in the night before and talk to these people and then come back the following day, and that's what we were to do. So it was and I just thought this was the best thing, I wasn't sure. I liked giving a bed bath particularly, but I love the interaction with people.
And you're such an extrovert.
But nursing was good. Nursing was really good. And, you work very hard.
Yeah.
And there were a few people in my class who were absolutely brilliant. And they're not even nurses anymore. Well, not most of us are not, actually.
Yeah. And was there a point where you had to choose your field of nursing? Because you...
No, no.
At what point did you go into midwifery?
Oh, I didn't like living in the city. That was the big thing. I hated Toronto. I said I could have been dead for a week, and the only thing that would have... been noticed that I would have smelt that bad, and that might have brought people around. I was lonely, and it was fine when I was working, but if I wasn't working, it was very lonely, unless I had babysitting jobs, which then kept me with people and kept me looking after kids and that. Shift work I found at first very difficult, and then I realized that night shift was really good because you'd have loads of time to talk to people.
Mm.
And during day shift, you were running like a fool to get things done. But at night, you had all the time in the world to talk to your patients. That was very nice. But I knew I wanted to get out of the city. I didn't like Toronto. I didn't want to stay there. So the Bishop of Quebec had said, any time I wanted a job on the Lower North Shore, to just let him know. So at one point I...
Which is just, can you geographically situate in words where the Lower North Shore is?
Okay. It's off the tip of Newfoundland, across from the Gulf of the St. Lawrence. It's the shoreline following the Quebec border between, from Labrador down to... The Lower North Shore is from boundary of Labrador down to a community called Kagaska. The next community down is part of the Mi'kmaq Nord.
Okay.
And Natashquan is Mi'kmaq Nord, and Kagaska is Lower Labasco Nord.
So you were able to get a job up
there?
Yes,
I was able to get a job up there. Well, through the bishop.
And this is like, so I've been to the Lower North Shore, exactly where you worked,
mm-hmm.
and... This is an extremely remote and probably at the time even more remote area, or
yeah,
I'm not sure. Remote. I mean, you went to St. Augustine, which is a small community where you have to take a plane to get to.
In 1973, and it was very remote. It was, I didn't even know how far remote it was until I got there.
this is a bit more of an adventure than Toronto.
Well... I seem to be able to get myself into adventures and then figure them all out. It's not something I figure out and then go to them.
Yeah.
My planning skills are minimal, but it just happened.
Yeah.
So went up to the Lower North Shore and then I was supposed to go to a town called Mutton Bay, and Mutton Bay is a community of about 600 people, had quite a good, nice nursing station, and but then but when I got to the coast, when I got to Blanc Sablon, which was our sort of resource center, I was told no, I wasn't going to Mutton Bay, I was going to St. Augustine. St. Augustine, a much bigger community of over 1,000 people, and it needed two nurses. So I was going to St. Augustine, and I was supposed to have an orientation period of a couple of days in Blanc Sablon. And so when I arrived the night before, they said, oh, your orientation will start at 9 tomorrow morning. And at 7:15, somebody came banging at my door to say, the helicopter's waiting for you. You're leaving at 8. And I said, where am I going at 8? Oh, you're going to St. Augustine. I said, I thought I was having a couple days of orientation. Oh, no. But you'll get those in St. Augustine.
You'll get it on the job. Orientation will be baptism
by
fire.
The more important thing was the helicopter's waiting for you. And I went, no, it's not.
No. I ain't taking no helicopter.
I'm quite happy to fly, but not in that thing. Anyway,
Did you get in the helicopter?
Oh, yes. Got on the helicopter. And I sat there with my knuckles turning white, and I probably looked a little pale. Lovely pilot. His name was Bill Kipke, and he was just the nicest fellow. Anyway, so he pointed things out to me. He said, now that's St. Paul's River, and you see that, that's Bredor. And he pointed out all the different communities to me along
the
way.
That was your orientation.
Yeah, my orientation. Anyway, he was very good. And he flew fairly, not low, but low enough for me to see well what the coast looked like. Mm. And it was a lovely, lovely day. And he said,
beautiful.
And that's an iceberg. And I said, this is July. He said, yeah, there have been a few of these big, big ones that have come down this July. And he said, by the time it gets to Sept-Îles, it'll be just a lump of ice. Then he told me a little more about St. Augustine. Then he said, now over that hill is your village. And all I could see was rocks. How did he know which rock was...
It was yours.
Yeah, because it was a very, very strange place. It was just all rocks. And anyway, he said, there's a tower there. And that's a communications tower. And just over there is the village. And then we popped up in the village. And all of a sudden, we were landing on this pad, which had a great big circle and an H on it. So I got out of the helicopter, and Bill took all my bags out. I started my life in St. Augustine. And
how long were you in St. Augustine for?
I went there in 73. I was there until 76. And then I went to, this was the continuation. I went to Dalhousie to take a course in outpost nursing. And then I came back and...
You went back to St. Augustine.
In 78 after I'd done the course.
And you were delivering babies.
I was delivering babies. Well, I did a lot more delivery. We delivered a few when I was in St. Augustine at first. But I realized I didn't have the skills to work in an outpost. As I had skills to work as a nurse, but I didn't have the skills to work in an outpost. I needed more actual learning. So I applied to Dalhousie to do their outpost nursing course. It was a completion or filling in the gaps of what I needed to know for working in an outpost. Part of the course was midwifery, because on the coast, having a baby was considered emergency management and treatment. So when people came into the nursing station, they would say, I'm going to be sick usually it was 8 months or 7 months from then.
I'm going to be sick.
I'm going to be sick.
Wow.
Well, because you had to go to hospital to have a baby. So what do you go to hospital for if it's not to be sick? It was an interesting expression because I had to figure that one out. And it didn't take long to learn the language, to learn the dialect.
How do you know you're going to be sick?
Yeah.
I
wish I knew when I was going to be sick. But okay. I do up prenatal work and say, now this is when you have to come and see me throughout this. Why? They'd say, well, because you need to have care during your pregnancy so that you have a really healthy pregnancy as well as healthy delivery. Oh, my mother didn't. I said, your mother didn't have the options either, and now you do. So that was really interesting. It was interesting working with moms who really had no experience with proper training.
And probably this was probably one of the first times that they had the resources to receive that kind of care. Like, you were the person that they would go to for that education.
They had, and there was no literature, none. Right. You have to understand, there was no library in town. Mm. People had a few books, but, you know, they used to come to the nursing station and they'd say, what do you do with all the books? Well, we read them. Oh, for pleasure? It always seemed to be very strange to them to read.
I fear that that's happening now.
Well,
what do we do with all these books? Why don't you have all these? Why not phones?
Yeah. Well, again, phones didn't work.
Yeah.
We did have a radio telephone that connected us with the hospital.
And can you tell the story about how you met Dad?
Sure. Our Marie Carey had been a lay reader on the coast, and therefore had connections with the Anglican Church. And the Anglican Church had churches all the way along the coast. And each community that they had a church in, they had a radio in, because the church in most of these northern communities is a connecting point. Mm. It's always how you get to know people is through the church, whether it be the Anglican, United, Roman Catholic. All the churches have different connections in different communities that they nurture. And on the coast, it's the Anglican Church. We would have a scheduled time, morning and evening. So it was at a 8 in the morning and at 5:15 in the afternoon. And you'd go on your skid. And our radio had a number of different crystals. So this is a single sideband. So your connection is really quite good. We could talk across the 400 miles of space on the northern shore between Kagask and Blanc de Blanc. And after I came back from Dalhousie was when I continued that skid on. Bruce was the priest in St. Paul's River at the time.
Bruce as in my father.
Yes, your father. And he had made quite a name for himself amongst many people. Like, I'd heard about him through Marie Carey.
He was a bit of a superstar.
Yeah, he was a bit of a superstar.
Bit of a rock star.
During the summer months, it was our connection with the ships coming in with freight. We had three ships. We had two freight ships only, and one that was passenger freight. And they would be able to communicate with me on single sideband, and then I would send out the message on double sideband to the communities to tell them how much freight they were bringing in. And it was something that Bruce used to listen to too, because he would need to know what freight was coming in for St. Paul's River so that he could give it to the dock in St. Paul's.
So did you and Dad communicate over radio? And yeah. Then, right.
I don't think we ever spoke on the telephone. Mm-hmm. We don't think we ever had communication by phone that worked. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And then you met in person.
Well, we met, yes. It was almost a full year after I got back from Dal. And our school had taken down a piece of the school and then built a new section that was a lot bigger and a lot more modern. And so the reopening of the school was an occasion. And so everybody of importance across the coast was invited, and that included all the clergy and some of the, most of the principals from across the coast. And so he was invited to come up. Anyway, I was out on a house call when he arrived, but I recognized his voice right away. And I said, I you'll have to save me a seat because I've got a call to do and then I'll be back. So he did. He saved me a seat. And then we went back to the nursing station afterwards, and I had good scotch. which was an important part of life. And so we had a few drinks, and then whenever he came to St. Augustine after that, we would usually have a meal together. And
the rest is history. Yeah. And 3 kids later, here we are.
Yes. Yeah.
What do you think that you, as a midwife, obviously seeing a lot of new mothers and following up with new mothers, what did you learn as a midwife, and what would you maybe tell new mothers in the early days of motherhood, or in their pregnancy?
Get all the rest you can. When baby's sleeping, you sleep. Don't try and serve anybody else but the baby. Everybody else can really look after themselves, and if you're lucky enough not to have little ones at home. If you do have little ones at home, find somebody to come in and help you. You need as much sleep as you can get. The baby needs you to be rested, because there's nothing worse than being overtired and having a baby yell at you.
Did you follow your own advice when you had...
When I had you, I got fairly sick with a breast abscess with you. And that was within the first few days. Huge red lump in one breast, and I was sick. I had a fever. I was really ill. And the doctor was wonderful. You know, it didn't take a minute. Got hold of the doctor, and she had me on antibiotics very quickly. Now, whether that was because I had been doing too much, I don't think I was. I think it was just, I'm fair, and abscesses happen often to fit people who are fair. You were a very small baby. Very small. You were 6 pounds. But I had enough milk for about 6 babies. And so you didn't empty the cauldron.
The resource.
And, yeah, the resources were all there. And I think that doesn't help any either. You know, you need to be able to figure out if you haven't emptied your breast, you need to empty it some other way.
Mm-hmm. So how did having children at an older age affect the way that you raised us? So you had me at, you were 34 and turned 35 2 days later, and then you had Rosamond at 40 and Timothy at 42?
43.
And I guess in the 80s and early 90s, that was a bit unconventional to have children. I think women are having children older and older, and because of, you know, there's the option and the accessible option of IVF and freezing eggs and stuff. So I think now women are having children older, but what...
You still have a number of the problems that happen because of hormones at a certain age.
Absolutely.
Yes,
yeah.
You still have those.
But your experience, was this a choice to have children older? How did it affect the way that...
I didn't get married until then.
You got married at 33. And Dad, also, I think it's worth saying, was... How old was Dad when I was
42.
Born? 42.
Well, 42 when we were married, 43 when you were born.
So you were, you know, in those days considered an older couple.
Oh, yes. We were definitely an older couple.
In the
couple.
Early 80s, yeah.
And when Timothy was born, I was the same age as some of the grandparents.
But how do you think that's affected you
I was fairly laid back as a mother, I think. I don't think I sweated over the small stuff, as they would say. If you got hurt, I'd bandage, you know, put a Band-Aid on it, and you'll be fine. You will heal, and you did. Mm-hmm. And all three of you, the same thing. I allowed you a fair bit of freedom. As soon as you wanted to learn to do stairs, that was fine. You just had to learn how to go down them. And so you all learned how to go downstairs very quickly. There was no, you know.
And do you think at an earlier age you would have been a bit more...
Oh, yeah. I would have been much more hyper about it all.
Skittish. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As you get older, you realize that life happens. But the other thing was, growing up when I did, like, we didn't wear bike helmets. We didn't wear seatbelts. Not that that's not a good thing, but I think sometimes we're obsessive about safety, although these days you can't not be. You know, there's many more external problems that can happen. I just think being older, I was more accepting of day-to-day events.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still remember when Rosamund fell in at school and cut the back of her head.
I remember that.
It didn't take me long to get her to the hospital and everything else, but you'll heal.
Right. You stayed calm. And
yeah, yeah. You will heal. You'll be okay. And I think that's what when you are older.
Yeah, there's a value to having a bit more, you know, a decade more of life experience.
Yeah, and I think that's what you'll heal. Really you'll be okay. Yeah, everything will be fine.
And if you don't mind talking about, you had a miscarriage between Rosamund and I.
Yeah.
And you also moved across the country with a 7-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a a 7-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 6-month-old.
No, 6 months. Three weeks.
3 weeks, right. So you moved across the country. You upped and moved your family across the country.
That's from Prince Albert to Quebec.
Saskatchewan, yeah. So can you just because I think that miscarriage and postpartum depression are things that we do not talk about enough, and as I'm sort of circling around the idea of motherhood and also friends that are going through the early years of motherhood and also going through miscarriages and postpartum depression, it's so present in everyday lives, but there's this myth of the glowing, beautiful mother and you know that everything is just wonderful and daisies and roses the whole time.
That's a myth. It's a pleasant myth, but it is a myth. We had been trying very, very hard to have a second child, and Bruce had been for many, many tests, and I had been for a number of tests too. I had laparoscopy done to see whether there were any problems uterine or in the fallopian tubes or any problems. And it was determined that I was just fine. I had loads of eggs, and that was great. So it was a matter of, you know, we had a wonderful doctor from Saskatoon who talked to us about the fact that if there's one little sperm that's wiggling, it's all you need to fertilize an egg. And if the eggs are all there, but sometimes the eggs weren't always there. So that was the problem. But and at one point, we did conceive, and it just died. It died at about 11 weeks.
Okay.
So it wasn't viable, and nor had it had developed into a fetus, but it wasn't a developed fetus.
Did you have to have surgery, or did it come out naturally?
No, I had to have a DNC.
What's a DNC?
Dilation cortège. They go in and they scrape out your uterus.
Right.
It's quite a simple procedure now done in day surgery, actually. It's not... If you have a death in utero now of a full or semi-full term fetus, you usually have to deliver it normally.
Yeah.
But with a blooded ovum, they need to scrape it out. They need to get the placenta out, and that takes a bit of.
Was that a traumatic experience for you? The whole process, or do you feel because of your education?
I had known it was dead for a long time,
and you've been educated about these things.
Yeah, the doctor. The doctor said, "Oh no, it was still viable, but it hadn't been," and so the medical people were all of a sudden getting excited, and I said, you know, you should have gotten excited a month ago if that was the case, because actually they only did the DNC when I was about 19 weeks, which, you know, that's a fair length of time between it had been dead since, you know, for
that's 10 a whole weeks. 2 months.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and in that case, you can end up with a lot of problems like septicemia. Actually, the worst one would be septicemia.
Yeah.
And it, was it traumatic? Yes. And it was, luckily our brains don't hang on to a whole lot of that crap.
It's okay, you can swear on this podcast.
We're made to remember the good things. When I think back, we were alone. You know, we didn't have family out there. So there was nobody for real support. I don't remember really talking to anyone. I don't even think I talked to Bruce. Talk to the doctor. Our doctor in Prince Albert was a wonderful man. Just one. And he was very conscious of that. I guess I saw him after I had the DNC. He had me come in twice or three times, and he was very conscious of how was I feeling, how were things going, was I coping. And I think in many ways you persuade yourself you're doing fine. Now whether you are or not, whether you suppress it, and
then you had a little miracle. Rosman was born. I still remember the day you told me Rosman was happening.
Yeah.
I remember how excited I was.
Yeah.
And then when you had Timothy 2 years later, mm-hmm. and you had moved across the country with your family. Timothy was whatever, three weeks old.
Well, he was born the 31st of December, and we started our trek on the 20th of January.
And Dad was the reason.
He was working.
Yeah, Dad was ushered into this new big job. And you just told me recently that you had your experience with postpartum depression. What were your symptoms?
Fatigue. Huge amount of fatigue. Crying at the drop of a hat, which I've never... I do that quite naturally. But this was even... This was worse because it wasn't happy cry. It wasn't a sort of emotional cry. It was sadness cry. And I couldn't understand why, because that's, you know, you've got this beautiful child in front of you, and you can't understand why you're so sad. It just doesn't make any sense. And so you really figure that you're to blame for this. This is your fault.
I've heard that from so many mothers.
Yeah, it's just I'm a bad mom. I'm a bad mom because I can't really see the beauty of this child. Well, you do see the beauty of the child, but everything inside you is achy. You know, is not happy. The doctor put me on medication. The medication lifted my mood slightly, but it everything else went a little screwy.
Like what?
I'd hallucinate, and I'd have all sorts of crazy thoughts, and the being sad wasn't necessarily depressive, although it could have moved into that, I suppose. But the other side of the coin was it was almost worse because you were sort of running on high octane, and you felt as if you were just running and not getting anywhere. Eventually, it wore off, like all things do. It does wear off, and you function as a parent,
and you
get on with it. Yeah, and there was a lot of getting on to do because once we got to Quebec, your father was not around.
Mm-hmm.
He was in the office, or he was away,
mm-hmm.
and
you were.
Yeah,
alone
it.
With
I was it.
Three kids,
yeah.
A dog, a cat,
and a new
job for yourself too.
Yes, when he was consecrated, we had 110 people for lunch.
Yeah.
just 110 people for lunch.
Yeah. So now, three children later, everyone is out of the house.
Yeah.
Retirement.
Mm.
Is there anything that you would have done differently, knowing...
Everything. Except for you guys. I would have been a nicer person.
You feel like you weren't a very nice person?
Yeah, no. I feel as if I was a little too outspoken. Not as kind as I might have been.
Really?
Yeah.
That's surprising, because I'm sure if we met everyone that has encountered you, they would say the opposite.
Jeez. Well, but you see, that's internally, you know. Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I would have been a nicer person.
Is there anything that you learned... I told you there would be tears.
Yes.
Is there anything that you've learned from your own mother?
Oh, I wish I'd learned a lot more. She was so able. She wasn't always nice, though. I learned not to listen to superstitions. Maybe that's a good one. Volunteering. Mom volunteered. Even when she was working full time, she would volunteer her time, her extra time. Mom always gave. Shouldn't do this just after Mother's Day.
Yeah, the timing.
She gave a huge amount of her time to anybody, everybody.
And you think you got that from her?
Well, I don't give nearly as much as Mom did.
Well, I think there's a lot of people that would contest.
No, I do like to have my own way.
Did you learn any mothering skills or anything about motherhood watching your own mom? I mean, I know it's a different, it was such a different time.
Yeah, it was a different time. Mothering skills. No. Actually, we had a wonderful maid who had wonderful mothering skills. She never had her own children, but she had the mothering skills. She was the nurturer. She was the one who would take time and sit down and talk to us and let us talk, let us vent. I think that's maybe one of the things. Venting. Kids need to vent. They always need to get rid of it. And if there's nobody there to do that, if nobody's there to hear them, that's a problem.
So, it can manifest in other ways, in violence.
Yeah,
and I say,
yeah, all sorts of things. But if you've got an introvert child who isn't able to vent, they internalize so much, and that can cause all sorts of extra problems.
Mm-hmm. What would you still like to experience while you still can?
Whatever comes my way.
You're open.
Yep. I'd love to have grandchildren.
For some reason, I knew you were going to say that.
But more because I see, you know, my siblings with grandchildren.
And great-grandchildren.
And great-grandchildren, yes. Well, I'd like to see my children happy.
What's something people don't know about you?
Very little.
You're an open book.
I'm an open book. I wear everything on my sleeve. I hate being angry. It makes me angry to be angry. You know, I just... The girl that was standing at the door... the nursing station when I arrived. I remember, you probably know the story anyway, but at one point she said to me, I asked her if she was going on to university to do something else. And she said, oh, I'm only a fisherman's daughter. And she didn't come back to work for 3 days. I was so mad. I just raged. I yelled at her. I said, how dare you insult your father that way? Mm. And she'd never really thought about it. I said, there's nothing only about your dad. He is many, many things, but he's never only a fisherman. And I wish I hadn't got that angry. I needed to get that message across, but I wish I hadn't got that angry.
Can you complete the last sentence? Diana is a vehicle for...
caring.
Mom, thank you. Don't make me cry.
I'm a care orienter.
It's just, true, you are.
Yeah, it's and so nurturing children, nurturing you, nurturing anybody comes naturally. So mm-hmm. No, I'm...
Mom, thank you so much for being on my podcast.
You're welcome.
Let's go get drunk.